This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. This is going to be one of those slowly, then all at once things, right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday today, the 23rd of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Okay, this is the last time I'm going to use this word, I promise, because clearly the sanctions on Russia are going to be rolled out bit by bit, depending on what the Russians do. But we got the second tranche of those sanctions today, the second slice. U.S. sanctions on the company that is building the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is a subsidiary of Gazprom, the state-owned Russian energy company. That is today's news. We, though, wondered what the sanctioned future might bring.
My name is Julia Friedlander. I'm the Seaboyd & Gray Senior Fellow and Director of the Economic Statecraft Initiative at the Atlanta Council.
We got Ms. Friedlander on the phone to ask about systemic financial sanctions the Biden administration might impose, not the relatively targeted ones they have opted for so far. Specifically, something called, in full, Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunication.
Switch is a messaging system. Think of it almost as a financial outlook. So it messages transactions before they actually show up on a bank's balance sheet. It's, think about greasing the skids within the financial system, especially if you're moving large amounts of money around.
SWIFT, it's called. Kind of the plumbing of global finance, if you will.
SWIFT is an independent or private organization operating out of Belgium. You know, they are subject to EU and Belgian regulation. Obviously, there's close communication between them and the U.S. just based on the role that they play. But they're sort of a unique actor in the global financial ecoverse, so to speak.
Now, we should be clear here. SWIFT is one of those things that gets bandied about quite a bit, acted on not quite so much.
We talk about it a lot because, quite frankly, this is the late John McCain talked about this a lot in the Russia context in 2014. It seemed like it was going to be a way to hit Russia hard at low cost to Western economies, when in fact it would probably be equally borne by debtors and creditors, right? So there, that would increase costs of transactions also for those doing business with Russia outside of Russia.
Sanctions, as the president said yesterday, can cut both ways. SWIFT is a real good example of that. Speaking of which, the cutting both ways thing. Crude oil today, the global benchmark Brent crude up only about 0.5%, $97 and change a barrel. Equities today, stocks, a little bit of invasion indigestion at the corner of Wall Street and Broad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One of the really strong areas in this economy the past couple of years, as we've all spent more time in and around home, has been improving them. The big box chain Lowe's, which, by the way, if you Google it, comes up as Lowe's Home Improvement. They told shareholders today that same-store sales were up 5% in the fourth quarter, and they figured to do maybe $99 billion in sales this year. That's after Home Depot reported an 8% increase in same-store sales yesterday. And a big reason for the improvement optimism, a very big reason, housing stock in this economy that just keeps on getting older. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
In 2005, the median age of an owner-occupied house in this country was 31 years. It's been climbing ever since to about 40 years today. Why?
Well, the fact that we're not tearing down and building new as quickly as we might want or as quickly as we need to meet the new demand.
Grant Farnsworth is president of the Farnsworth Group, a home improvement research firm. He says years of underbuilding following the mid-aughts housing crash have pushed up the overall age of the housing stock, along with demand for updates.
The older the home, the more need, true need there is to do projects such as HVAC, windows, you know, efficiency-related projects, roofing.
Those kinds of replacement projects make up about half of home improvement spending, according to Abby Will, who follows the industry at Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. She projects home improvement spending will grow 17% this year nationally, partly driven by inflation. The long-term average is about 5%.
So anything above 5% is strong growth. And then certainly when we're in the 10% and 15% and 20% range, that's incredibly strong growth.
Unsustainable even, and Will expects that growth to peak this year. Rising mortgage rates could slow down home buying, and a lot of home improvement happens right before and right after a sale. Sam Cater is chief economist at Freddie Mac. He says even then, the shortage of homes for sale will continue to fuel demand.
For those that want to move but can't find the right home, then they sort of look at their own home and say, okay, well, how can I change this into, if it's not my dream home, you know, maybe my close to dream home. In fact, we've got a neighbor, and that's exactly what they're doing.
Which is great if you can afford it. And a lot of homeowners, flush with rising equity and pandemic savings, can. The problem with an aging housing stock is that a lot of people can't. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
In the world of fresh economic data today, we got... Wait, give me a minute. Hang on. Okay, tomorrow we get jobless claims and new home sales. Friday is inflation and consumer sentiment. Today, Bupkis. Turns out today is one of the increasingly rare non-holidays when the federal government or big university or private company is not releasing a big new batch of marquee economic data. So, hey, Matt Levin, all that data that's out there most days, what good's it doing us?
So, yeah, there's no major economic data that's coming out today, which apparently doesn't mean I get the day off. Neither does Maria Arias, a data engineer at FRED, the St. Louis Fed's incredibly popular economic data site.
So today we should see the Euro short-term rate update, harmonized indices of consumer prices, or HICP, secured overnight.
This goes on for a while, even though Arias says today is pretty light. Back in the day, it used to be much lighter. FRED started tracking 30 kinds of data in 1991. Now it's up to 800,000. Most of that is actually government data that just wasn't accessible to the public until new data apps and the internet came along. It's basically irresistible to economists.
I checked FRED no more than 14 times this morning.
Justin Wolfers is a labor economist at the University of Michigan. He says having payroll and unemployment and even restaurant reservation data at his fingertips is an economist's dream. And it must make them better at forecasting the future, right?
The evidence seems to be if we are only a little bit.
How is that possible? How can economists in 2022 only be marginally better at predicting, say, jobs numbers than Paul Volcker was using graph paper and an abacus in 1978? Wolfer says either there's something fundamentally unknowable about the economy.
Or that the constraint is not the quality of our data, but maybe instead the quality of our economic insights.
Even if we're not forecasting much better, we at least don't have to wait as long to see what's happening, says Yale finance professor Bill English.
We want to know what's going on now. I think we have gotten better at that, actually.
English says he'd like even more data. Asking an economist if there's too much data in the world is like asking a six-year-old if there's too much candy. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
The good people at the National Retail Federation figure we spent about $24 billion on Valentine's Day this year. That's up from $22 billion last year. Christina Stemple is the CEO and founder of a direct-to-consumer flower company called Farm Girl Flowers. We've talked to her a couple of times over the past couple of years. Most recently, how shipping delays and the deluge of refunds that meant kind of took the bloom off the rose of Valentine's Day for her last year. So with that holiday in the rearview mirror again, we've gotten her back on the phone to ask how things went this year.
Well, I mean, the bar was very low, as you just mentioned last year. So it definitely surpassed that, which was great. But we went into this one knowing it was going to be probably the most challenging Valentine's Day, at least in a while, since it was on a Monday this year, which is the worst day of the week to ship from.
Why?
Because for most people don't realize this, I wouldn't either, but for small and medium companies, we're not created equal with the big companies. And so we can't get weekend pickups for Monday deliveries.
From FedEx and UPS and them? Is that what you're talking?
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah, from the big transportation companies. So we only had one location that we could ship from to arrive on Monday, and that was our South America location. And so we had to, leave money on the table from that location because we didn't want to put all of the eggs in that basket again.
So what did you do other than, leave some money on the table? I mean, was it less stressful? Did you just say whatever happens, happens? How'd you do it?
We definitely had to, really think about, I had to think about how much risk I was willing to take on. Mm-hmm. And then we had a lot of other things playing against us, as well as with something that people are starting to read a lot about right now with, the Apple privacy settings and how that impacts small and medium businesses as well. Oh, so much with marketing. We have, under $100 average order value. And so we can't afford to spend $50 to acquire a customer that's going to spend $100.
Right, wait, so back up for a minute. So we'll get to the Apple thing in a second, because that, frankly, is fascinating to me. But the logistics hurdles, all of inflation, I mean, all of that other stuff, you're just kind of dealing with it as a small to medium business person kind of has to do?
Absolutely. It's just a lot of responding very quickly and trying to do our best to mitigate risk and also figure out better ways to do things, the same things that we used to do very differently.
Are you raising prices?
Yes, absolutely. Our prices were significantly higher this year. Valentine's Day is, typically a holiday that people will spend more than Mother's Day, actually, which is a little
really?
Bit sad to me.
That tells you something. I don't know what's going on there.
Absolutely. It's a lot of, we had to pass some of that on to consumers because, there are things like even with supply chain that the price going up 20x on container pricing, that impacts our industry because that's how all the bulbs and tubers come to the growers to be able to plant. And so that, for instance, roses were more than double the price that we typically pay for a rose. We paid for Valentine's Day.
Wow.
We had to pass that on.
Yeah, yeah. First of all, that goes to show you I did not buy roses for this Valentine's Day. But that's a whole different thing. But how do you get the message across to consumers that, hey, look, everything's going to be more expensive, deal, without them going, I don't need to buy flowers this year?
So, we just believe in transparency. So we just explain it. We also did some kind of creative ways, of how to spread it out. So the prices go up for about a week and a half period of time. Mm. And we, blended it out over a month. So that really helped. So we didn't have to, double our prices, but we could go up like 25% and then spread it out longer.
Hmm. All right. So let's get back to this Apple thing. For those who aren't aware, Apple has changed its privacy rules and it's no longer letting you be tracked across all these different platforms, and that is making it tough for you, small business person, to get in front of your customers. And you're having to pay more to acquire a customer, I guess. Is that the deal?
Absolutely. We used to spend about 5% on marketing, and now we're looking at more like 30 to 50% on marketing. And it's more than we can afford with perishable products that have tiny margins.
Get away from percentages. How much money are you spending to acquire a new customer?
Yeah, we used to spend about $8.65, and now it's anywhere between $33 and $60.
That's insane. How do you run a business like that?
You don't very successfully if you do that. So we are, in the position of, we want to be profitable, not just growth at all costs.
Although it's very interesting because if I remember correctly, the first time you and I spoke, which now seems like a very long time ago, you were like, grow, man, I got to grow, right?
Yep. Very different now. I've learned a lot, especially in the last 3 years. It's just my philosophy has changed. It's definitely more about I need to run a healthy company. So it's my responsibility to my team to keep us here long term. And that's getting harder and harder to do.
You lost a boatload of money last year, Valentine's Day. You wound up having to lay off
I think it was like 200 people, right? Something like that?
Yeah, over 200. About two-thirds of our company.
Are you healthy now? Are you sustainable now?
Yeah, we're sustainable now. We're smaller now, but sustainable as far as team members go. We're about 100 people instead of over 300. Yeah. You know, not what I wanted to do, but it's what I needed to do to be here long term.
Christina Stemple, she's the CEO, also the founder of Farmgirl Flowers. Christina, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time, as always.
Thanks for having me on again, guys.
Yeah, we'll talk to you soon. Coming up.
We were just working, coming home to sleep, working, coming home to sleep.
Time to make the donuts. But first, let's do the numbers. Interesting. I don't know if I'd have gone with the Wawa's, but once again, I'm not in charge. Dow Industrial's down 464 today, 1.4%, 33,131. The NASDAQ gave up 344 points, 2.6%, 13,037. The S&P 500 down 79, 1.8%. 42 and 52. All right, maybe the Wawa's. I don't know. Anyway, $32 billion. That's how much wealth Russian billionaires have seen vaporized so far, according to the Bloomberg Billionaires Index. The biggest loser, Gennady Timchenko, who made his billions in, wait for it, natural gas. Bloomberg figures he's watched about a third of his wealth disappear, largely thanks to sanctions. Bond prices yield on the 10-year T-note 1.98%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All the geopolitical attention right now, rightly, is on Russia and Ukraine. But a short 6 months ago, it was all Afghanistan, and it was all not good. The United States and its allies pulled out chaotically. The Taliban took over, also chaotically. And now Afghanistan's in the middle of an enormous humanitarian and refugee crisis, with tens of millions of people facing food insecurity and millions more with no steady income. So we got Dr. Medea Afzal on the phone. She is a foreign policy fellow at Brookings to talk things over. Dr. Afzal, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get too far into the specifics of what's going on, what is your broad sense of the Afghan economy in the 6 months since the United States left?
I mean, the Afghan economy is essentially in free fall since the U.S. has left. It was an extremely aid-dependent economy. 75% of the economy was dependent on aid. All of that aid has dried up, essentially. It is, at the same time, going through a massive humanitarian crisis, not only brought about by the fact that the aid has dried up, but because of drought and the fact that there's just not enough food for people to eat. And on top of that are huge sanctions that have been levied automatically on the country because of the Taliban takeover. And the final thing I'll mention is that there are foreign reserves that the Afghan Central Bank holds in the U.S. and in EU countries. And those, because of the Taliban takeover, have been frozen. What we see is a country that's unable to implement monetary policy.
Is there any relief coming from Afghanistan's neighbors at all? Any regional assistance?
There is, but the problem is there are limits, right? So, yeah. In fact, Pakistan and Iran, Afghanistan's two neighbors who have been in many ways most affected by the Taliban takeover, actually get some of the humanitarian relief that countries, including the US, including Japan, have been giving to Afghanistan because of the fact that there have been refugee flows from Afghanistan after the Taliban takeover into these countries. The UN has a huge appeal out, its largest appeal ever. $4.5 billion is what it's asking countries to pledge to Afghanistan, but that hasn't really been met with pledges. That humanitarian aid is limited, and that does not really counter the adverse effects of sanctions, of the freezing of reserves, and of, you know, in general, Western aid drying up after the U.S. Withdrawal from Afghanistan.
You know, one of the things you heard as the United States was pulling out was, oh my goodness, nobody could have predicted that the Afghan government was going to collapse as fast as it did and that the Taliban was going to take over as fast as it did. And in point of fact, a lot of people actually predicted that. And I guess my last question to you as a professional who studies this area, was this result of the economic chaos and the tragedy of famine and all of the horrible things that are happening over there? Was this foreseeable?
I think it was foreseeable. If the Taliban was going to take over, we should have known that our policy would have resulted exactly in this. Afghanistan was already on the precipice of a major humanitarian disaster, and it essentially fell off that precipice. And so that fact, you know, should have been a given. And then we should have realized in some ways that the leverage that we spoke about, sanctions, aid, etc., was not really leverage. And that would have harmed, as it is now doing, as we are now seeing playing out, the Afghan people far more than hurting the Taliban itself.
Dr. Medea Afzal, she's at Brookings. Dr. Afzal, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I talked about the Case-Shiller Home Price Index yesterday real quick, up at the fastest pace in 30-something years, just up. Well, rents are up as well, and housing, shelter as economists call it, is a big driver of inflation, and it's one of the many reasons that people are hitting the road in search of a new way of living. You've heard about van life, right? People living in vans. What about boat life, then? Here is the next installment of our series, Adventures in Housing.
I am Sunny.
And I am Brandon.
And we live on a boat.
In Titusville, Florida. The boat is an Alban Vega 27.
I can fully stand up in our boat with a little bit of headroom. Brandon cannot. You can stand up in two spots in the boat, a hatch and the companionway.
I can touch both sides standing in the middle of the boat.
He's a welder. I'm a server.
When we first got together as a young couple, I mean, we didn't have any savings. So the first 2 years of us being together was us just trying to get up a nest egg.
We were just working, coming home to sleep, working, coming home to sleep.
We both really wanted to travel and to see more of the world than we were used to coming from South Georgia. But we also knew that, like, traveling in a traditional sense, just when we have off time from work, especially coming from, like, our low salaries, was going to be hard.
We looked at a bunch of YouTube videos about van life specifically, and through that we found that people live on sailboats.
I was working night shift at the time and she was working day shift, so we had opposite schedules, and the couple of hours that we had in between switching shifts that we could spend together, we could escape and, you know, pretend that we were going to be somewhere far away on an island someday or seeing these beautiful places. We spent $5,000 on our boat when we first got her, but we've put in a lot of sweat equity since then.
Mm-hmm.
We have at least twice what we bought her for in her.
We had to, when we bought the boat, she actually did not have a head, which is what we call the toilet. She didn't have a toilet. So we had to rip out an old liquor cabinet and install a head. So that doesn't actually have a door. That's just kind of in an old cabinet right next to our V-berth, which is where we sleep. And then we have a cat. So we have a litter box under the V-berth. He's a big cat and we have a small boat. So I was initially a little worried about him adjusting to boat life, but he adjusted super quickly.
So far, the cat's only made it into the water one time.
He did fall overboard once. We kind of just pick up a job when we need it. I would say our monthly expenses now, on average, are a lot cheaper than living in an apartment in Atlanta.
You can pretty much anchor, depending on the anchoring laws, wherever you are, and not have to pay rent.
We don't have to work every single day just to survive. I've seen dolphins, manatees, sea turtles bigger than I am, jellyfish, just everything from that cockpit.
My favorite thing is the stars at night, is just looking up and being so far out that there's not as much light pollution. And our first passage, it was during a meteor shower full of more meteors than I've ever seen in my life.
Man, that sounds pretty nice, huh? Pretty nice. Sonny Blanding and Brandon Bunch on a 27-foot sailboat. They're in Titus, Florida. Tell us, would you, about your adventure in housing. Make us a little jealous like they did. Marketplace.org is where you can do that. This final note on the way out today, which I offer for your information as always, but I will be silently shaking my head in disagreement. I saw this on Bloomberg the other day in a story about streaming TV deals and how much some old linear series sold for in the new streaming economy. Basically, the per-episode cost to the streamers to acquire the rights to show those shows. The most expensive show per episode? Any guesses? And here's where the head shaking comes in, because I guess I just never quite got this show. The Office, for which Peacock paid Universal $500 million, works out to $498,000 an episode for a 5-year deal back in 2019. I know I'm lame. I'm sorry. All right, we're done. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. A very quick follow to my item yesterday about mortgage interest rates up above 4%. From the Mortgage Bankers Association today, this item, perhaps related, mortgage applications down to the lowest they've been since the before times. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostet, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.